Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta on this Friday, August 30th. Traffic is moving pretty smoothly this morning in the Wasatch Back, just seeing some backups on the I-80 to US 40 interchange. A bit chilly this morning, but it's shaping up to be a really nice weekend, it looks like. On the line with me to talk more about weather, I've got Cedric Haynes, meteorologist with ABC4. How's it going, Cedric?
So much, and as you mentioned, it is a chilly start out there in the Heber Valley. Temperatures in the upper 30s in some spots this morning, so quite the shock. But otherwise, we've got lots of sunshine, and it will be a pretty nice day as we go throughout this afternoon. We're going to be looking at that sunshine, but the one thing you're going to notice, we started to see this a little bit yesterday. We will see it again a little bit more, I think, as we go throughout today. Is some of that smoke and haze that will start to fill the sky. That's all coming from those strong wildfires that are ongoing right now across portions of Idaho. And so the winds coming out of the north are going to help tug down some of that smoke and haze as we go throughout this afternoon. But it won't completely block the sunshine out. So do call it mostly sunny, but you will notice some of that in the horizon. Also, it will play a little part in our air quality, creating moderate to at times code orange, unhealthy for sensitive group air quality alerts out there. So just kind of keep that in mind as well. If you suffer from things like allergies or especially like asthma, things like that, that you could have some issues as we go throughout this afternoon with that smoke and haze. Otherwise, as we go into your holiday weekend, starting off with your Saturday, we'll have more of that hazy sunshine, but it will start to warm up a little bit more. So instead of lows down into the 30s and 40s, we're talking low temperatures in the 40s and 50s for early Saturday morning. And then as we go throughout the day on Saturday, we're looking at those highs climbing into the mid 80s around Park City and highs in the upper 80s to around 90 in the Heber Valley. So the heat will be on as we go into your Saturday, and that will continue into your Sunday as well, as we get even warmer with highs likely in the mid to upper 80s in Park City, highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. And again, we're looking at a few more clouds, and there is a slight chance, and we're talking an isolated pop-up storm or two could develop. I wouldn't cancel my outdoor plans, and I wouldn't get too concerned about it, but there will be a slight chance as we get into your Sunday and Monday of an isolated shower. Otherwise, it's all about the heat and a mix of sun and clouds as we go throughout your Sunday into Labor Day Monday itself. After that, we've got another weak front that tries to move in as we go throughout your Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, and that will start to bring the temperatures back down just a little bit. So we're talking highs only around the upper 70s and low 80s in Park City, with highs back down into the mid to upper 80s across portions of the Heber Valley there, and we'll be drying things out, and overall we'll try to lower that humidity just a little bit more again. So overall, not a bad holiday weekend, as our Labor Day is looking partly cloudy skies with just that very slight chance of a pop-up storm, but those temperatures will be a little warmer. But hey, it's a holiday weekend, so I'm sure most don't mind that.
Parker? Yeah, I think we'll take it. I appreciate it, Cedric.
Thank you.
Have a
no
good
problem.
Weekend.
You too. Have a good one.
Well, good morning again. It's 8:09. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Coming up, we'll have a pre-recorded interview with members of the Utah Department of Transportation talking about new asphalt that is kind of transforming the way the state replaces roads. Then we'll be speaking with Park City Economic Development Program Manager Jenny Dearson. She'll have details on weekend's events and, of course, Miner's Day coming up on Monday. And then we'll end the hour with Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis to review some of the top stories from the past month. Now to get into some local news, the Park City School District Superintendent may be leaving town. KPCW's Christine Weller reports she is the only finalist for a position in Colorado.
Colorado Early Colleges is a network of tuition-free public charter schools for K-12 students. Its board announced Tuesday that Park City School District Superintendent Jill Gilday is the sole finalist for the Chief Executive Officer position at the organization. Documents from Gilday's application packet were released the same day. Under Colorado law, the public is allowed 14 days to review a candidate's application and qualifications before a school board can extend a job offer. In a cover letter dated June 19, 2024, Gilday expressed her enthusiastic interest in the executive officer position and wrote she is, quote, willing and prepared to relocate to Denver immediately to facilitate a smooth transition into this role. The superintendent was unavailable for comment Thursday. This comes 1 week after the Park City School District Board of Education renewed Gilday's contract in a split 3-2 vote. The renewal was controversial, as many parents and two board members requested a decision on her contract be delayed until January, when three new board members will be sworn in. It's unclear if the local board knew Gilday was applying for other jobs in June. According to Gilday's contract, she is supposed to promptly notify the board if she applies for other employment. In an email statement Thursday, the board said it's, quote, aware of reports in the press that the superintendent is a finalist for a job in Colorado. The board also said it's grateful for Gilday's contributions to the district over the past 6 years, and while it hopes she will continue on her current role, the board respects Gilday's choice. The board says it will update the community when it has more information. Board President Andrew Kaplan previously expressed concern about finding a new superintendent should Gilday choose to leave or the board decide not to renew her contract. He said a potential candidate will read negative things community members have written.
They're going to think twice about coming to our community because they're going to say, why would I go to that community when we have unreasonable people who just say mean things?
Board Vice President Wendy Crossland expressed a similar concern during the August 20th board meeting before voting to renew Gilday's contract. She said it could be difficult to attract a new superintendent with three new board members. If Gilday decides to leave the district, she must give at least 30 days written notice. If she fails to provide the notice, Gilday must pay a $2,000 early termination penalty. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Utah Department of Transportation recently developed a new asphalt mix that is weather-resistant and will transform the way the state replaces roads and reduces paving costs. KPCW's Connor Thomas sat down with UDOT engineer for asphalt Howard Anderson to talk about how this new pavement works.
All right, this is KPCW's Connor Thomas, and on the phone with me, I have Howard Anderson. He's UDOT's asphalt engineer, and with him, the executive director of the Asphalt Pavement Alliance, Reed Ryan. Thank you both, gentlemen, for coming on Local News Hour.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, you know, maybe just to start, either you, Reed, or Howard, could you give sort of a bird's eye view of sort of this new asphalt mixture that I understand UDOT is beginning to use around the state?
If you would like, I'll give you a bird's eye view. This is Howard Anderson. So we found that we could use a better asphalt with more polymers in it that was stronger and put more of that binder in the asphalt mix and make it much more durable and last longer for our public. And so that's a really exciting thing.
This is Reed. If I could add to that, what's interesting from my perspective is it doesn't sound like much, but really what Howard and the great folks at UDOT, some of the regional engineers like Lonnie Marchand and others, our binder suppliers in the state of Utah, they have taken about 40, 50 years of traditional mix design and really kind of turned it on its head and thought very differently about how we can construct an asphalt mix design. And now we're seeing the fruits of that labor. So it sounds like it's just a bit of, you know, ho-hum, it's another road, but really it's a bit of a revolution when it comes to asphalt mix design, which I think from a large perspective, a national perspective from my role now, it becomes very interesting.
Yeah, and I'm curious, Howard, when did UDOT begin to think about upsetting this decades-old asphalt mixture? About how many years ago?
For me, it's been a long journey, at least 10 years. I first learned about high mod binders at federal highway meetings. I came back and I met with our binder suppliers, and they are just excellent to work with. We have a very good relationship in our state through UAPA. And we started talking together about how can we make this binder? And they figured it out, and they found out how to make it pumpable, even while suppliers back east were struggling with it. The folks out here in the west figured it out. And we had our first project. The big first project was 3 years ago at the Wendover Port of Entry on Interstate 80, where you have all the trucks coming in from the California ports. And Lonnie Marchand, our Region 2 engineer, put it there. And he said, if it works here, it'll work anywhere. Reed, you want to add to that?
Yeah, no. And it's really been a hand-in-glove approach, which I think is what we've appreciated from representing industry and being able to work with Howard and the DOT. I think at times in life and in business, we can take a us versus them approach, and sometimes that serves us well and sometimes that doesn't serve us so well. And I think we could point to any number of examples in our modern day life. And what we found with the DOT is it's us with them. And I think this is really what the state is going to benefit from this asphalt mix, is this is industry working together with the DOT to come up with the best possible product.
And Reed, you're now at the National sort of Asphalt Pavement Alliance, but I understand you're Utah-based in Saratoga Springs, formerly at a state asphalt trade organization. I'm curious, because we've used a couple of technical terms already, like binders. Could you maybe take a step back and, for listeners who have no idea about asphalt engineering, explain a little bit about how just kind of the composition of the usual formula of asphalt, and then maybe a little bit about what this new formula being called HIMOD, what makes it different?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that's a really good point, because I think guys like Howard and I get really close to these things and we don't think through, you know, what does the general public understand and know? So if you were to look at an asphalt mixture, its constituent parts, you're really talking about 95% of that is aggregate. A portion of that aggregate can be recycled. In fact, asphalt is the most recycled product on the planet, which nobody knows about, but it's an amazing story that we need to tell more broadly to the general public. So 95% of that is either virgin aggregate or some portion of that is recycled aggregate through this wrap product. And then the 5%, which is really kind of where we're focused on, is this asphalt binder. And the asphalt binder, you know, it has its historical compositions through the refining process. We always joke that asphalt is the bottom of the barrel, but it's the most important part of the barrel for all of us in the industry. And what Howard's been able to do is, as he mentioned, is to think differently about how you build that actual binder and that component and the polymers that you put into that to kind of build a better binder. Because in Utah, we're in a very unique climate here. We have the most freeze-thaw cycles in the entire country. And we go really cold and we go really hot. And then we go really cold and we go really hot. And we bounce back and forth between all this. And so we need these binders to perform. We need them to have the elasticity and the ability to really allow that pavement to live, right? When you think about when you get really cold or when you get really hot, you want it to be both durable and structural. And so Howard's built a better binder. And to his credit, he's giving credit to our binder suppliers who have worked with him to be able to get that together. And then I think what we need to distinguish as well, Connor, just quickly, is that a HIMOD asphalt pavement is not a HIMOD asphalt pavement, is not a HIMOD asphalt pavement. And what Howard has basically discovered here in Utah is to not only use these highly polymer modified binders, but then to close the voids down and do a couple other different things around the asphalt mix that really, what we are calling a bulletproof asphalt pavement, if you will. It's an incredible product so far.
Gotcha. So it's kind of, you know, asphalt has crushed rock and then there's a glue, and you've kind of zeroed in on making a better glue.
Not only is it a better glue, Connor, but we're using more of that better glue. Typically, we can use maybe 5% asphalt in a mixture, and this mixture easily takes 6%. And by doing that, we have thicker films of the glue around the rocks, and we have it lubricated better. We can compact to higher densities that are much stronger and keeps the water out. And we can also lay this material down in one lift and potentially save a lot of time in the traffic control of a project instead of laying it down twice.
Yeah, and Howard, you mentioned the testing near Wendover. Since that's gone well, where else are you planning on paving this, and where have you already laid this pavement in the state?
So this pavement is currently on Interstate 15 near Parrish Lane, both north and south down on all five lanes, about 3/4 mile section of it. It was placed on concrete because that concrete road was going to be replaced in a few years, and it became a very good way to keep the road in good condition until that happens. It's also on a lot of bridge decks around the state. In fact, near the airport, you'll notice a lot of new bridge decks. Those are all highly modified asphalt bridge decks. And 54th South by Bangor Highway has it as well. This year, we have about a dozen projects going out, and the tonnage is surprise to everybody as it's approaching maybe 500,000 tons. Going up Harleys Canyon, you'll see it. Out on Interstate 80, mile marker 41 to 50, you see it. And US 6 has got a couple projects as well. And there's others.
And Connor, if I could add context to that just quickly, a state of Utah does about 4.1, 4.2 million tons of asphalt in a year. So to think that 500,000 tons of that is just this one particular product is pretty astounding and awesome.
And that's for the whole state. I don't think UDOT does that.
And yeah, UDOT is about 40% of that 4.1 million tonnages. So then if you divide that pie even farther, it's an incredible opportunity for the DOT.
Wow. Wow. And Howard, could you maybe go into more detail about the testing, too? Because, you know, us being a Wasatch Back radio station, I think the Parley's portion of the pavement, it's going to be top of mind for everyone about rain and then really snow, how slick it might be, because it's pretty smooth down there at the mouth of the canyon from what I've driven, which is really fun in the summer. But could you talk about that testing and what you've seen traction-wise in those extreme conditions?
That's a very good question, Connor. So we have skid testing that is done on our pavements to make sure that they're safe. And when a project is new, the asphalt films are thicker, and it is potentially more slippery when the asphalt pavement is new. What we expect, though, is that during this summer, that a lot of those films are going to be worn off due to the traffic, and the pavement will be in a much safer condition come in fall. The testing that we've done on it for skid has shown that it's similar to other hot mix asphalt pavements. The aggregates that are in this mix are similar to what we have in our other asphalt pavements. And so we've seen good friction with it, and we don't see any safety problems from it.
Good stuff. And Reed, maybe this is a question for you. How has this been received in the industry? Are increasing the number of polymers, creating different ones, is this a brand new idea for asphalt? And if so, is it spreading at all?
Yeah, great question. So I'll offer a distinction. The idea of a highly modified asphalt binder isn't necessarily new, but to the limits that Howard's been able to test and prove it out, and then also in combination of the other mix design factors where we talked about being able to get more of it into an asphalt mix because he's changing a few of the other parameters, that is pretty revolutionary. And as far as reception, there's a few avenues where this has been received, both on a regional level through presentations, through discussions. And then in my new role here with the Asphalt Pavement Alliance, just last month, we had a partnership call where this was discussed at length about what's happening here in Utah so that we can really start spreading it across the nation to ask, you know, those vital questions about what is different and how are you going to do it? And how does it change, you know, construction practices in general? Because you think of the driving public, one of the biggest concerns, you know, for our industry is we want to get in and out and get a new road. And we try our best not to slow folks down. And if we can, as Howard mentioned, pave this application a little bit thicker and remove those touch points where we have to be on a pavement multiple times, then that's a win for everybody, not only the public, but also for our industry and for the DOT.
Yeah, I'm not sure how competitive the asphalt industry is, but is this the sort of thing that you can patent and then sell to others?
So departments of transportation, we have our state money and we also have federal money. And it doesn't make sense to have a patent on something that has federal money when other state DOTs are also using federal money. And so the answer to the question is the departments of transportation share technology without even thinking about putting a patent on what they're doing.
Have any other states started using this pavement, to your knowledge?
Nobody is using it yet, but we have other states like Montana and Idaho and Colorado and Arizona that are talking with me and getting our specifications. Montana is actually planning a project.
I think to that point is it, the way the funding cycles work, you know, with the DOTs and with our fiscal year with the government, it's all about planning and being able to, you know, move ahead. And you're always looking a couple years in advance. So now we're getting into those cycles with these other DOTs so that they can appropriately budget and plan ahead for these applications. So it's all, I think we'll see a snowballing effect in the very near future.
And what have you seen as far as the cost of these materials here in Utah? Is UDOT able to save money up front? Is it a potentially cheaper polymer or more of those cost savings downstream once you have to do less maintenance, hopefully?
So cost-wise, if I was to give round numbers, our normal hot mix asphalt, you could say it's around $100 a ton, or it has been in the recent past. We have another mix called the Stone Matrix Asphalt that's a gap graded, meaning it's the aggregates are all similar size, like marble size, and it has to have mineral fillers and fibers in it to hold the higher binder content. That's our premium mix currently, SMA, and you could give it a number of $140 a ton. And that one has shown excellent performance. It has a density of 94%. The high mod currently is sitting right about in the middle. If you were to have the $100 a ton versus the $140, the high mod would be about $120. So it is actually cheaper than our currently premium product that we're using. And we have had projects change order to the HiMod to save money. And so if you hear UDOT saving that this is saying that we're saving money, they're saying that in the context of relating it to if we would have done our premium product, SMA, which we are currently doing all over the place, or should we go to the HiMod, which is cheaper, but it has a higher density of 96% and arguably can perform as well or better. And I don't know what you want to say to that, Reed.
Yeah, no, I think I'll just add a quick industry perspective for you, Connor. Is this HiMod mix, the way that you crush the rock is very different than what I would say are the top performing asphalt mixes of the past. Howard mentioned it. It's another technical term, but it's called stone matrix asphalt. And what happens when you crush that is you end up with what are called unbalanced pits, meaning that you have some of these rocks that you can't get back into the mix. And so you're not quite sure what to do with those. That becomes a cost for our producers. With this HiMod asphalt mix, that problem goes away because it's a balanced design in terms of the actual structure of the aggregates for the mix. And so I think that's where we're realizing the cost savings that the DOT is seeing, because the contractors are saying in essence, kind of hallelujah, like we don't have to worry now about this unbalanced pit design. We actually have these rocks readily available. We can crush them to the size, put them into the mix, and things are more efficient all along the process as a result. And so I think that's where we're realizing some cost savings.
And then for your average driver, Howard, I guess safe to assume if they pass a UDOT crew repaving something, there's a above 50% chance that's going to be the HiMod?
It's going that direction. You know, I can't guarantee that for now, but there's the HiMod is noticeably blacker and denser when you drive on it. And it, to me, I can tell the difference. And I think our general public is going to love this mix.
Definitely. Well, is there anything else that either of you would want to add?
I'll add one other thing. The HiMod also has the use of, Reed mentioned our RAP, the recycled asphalt pavement. So the HiMod is actually more sustainable than our current premium product because it allows 15% RAP in it. And it can do that because this binder is that much better. It has a better cold temperature property going clear down to minus 34 degrees Celsius compared to our stone matrix asphalt goes to minus 28, and so it can handle the wrap and still have excellent cracking performance. So in that respect, it's more sustainable.
Yeah, and Connor, I'll just add one thought, and I know I briefly touched upon it, but again, I feel like so often, especially, you know, we're in a state like Utah, you know, we can at times fall into the trap of viewing government versus industry is sitting at polar opposites. And I, in my career, I just don't believe that's the case. And I think this is proof in the pudding, if you will, that you can work hand in glove, you can work in an us versus them approach, and you can come up with something that's even better than we could have imagined. And that required a lot of collaboration, as Howard mentioned. It required a lot of meetings. It required some testing, you know, and he said he's been involved in research for about 10 years for this. But he didn't do it behind closed doors. He did it with, if you will, the proverbial arms wide open to say, here's what I'm thinking about, here's what we're going to try to do, and can industry help me get there? And the answer was yes. And then now here we have something that may indeed revolutionize the asphalt pavement industry, which is pretty incredible.
Thanks, Reed. Well, he is the executive director of the Asphalt Pavement Alliance. We've also been speaking with Howard Anderson, who's UDOT's asphalt engineer. Gentlemen, thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There aren't yet clear rules about e-bike usage in Wasatch County. After three teenagers were injured in a crash, KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports leaders are considering how to keep riders safe.
Three Wasatch High School students were hospitalized Monday after their e-bike collided with an SUV on Midway's Main Street. All three were wearing helmets. Three teen girls were riding together on one e-bike and made a U-turn when they did not have the right of way, according to police. The driver of the SUV was unable to stop in time to avoid hitting the teenagers. Heber City Police Sergeant Josh Weishar says local law enforcement is working on a plan to educate community members about proper e-bike usage.
Basically, because of that accident, Chief Sever has asked me and the traffic unit to put together a video or something to present to the community on what our rules and laws are for e-bikes. Currently, we follow the same rules and laws that the state follows when it comes to e-bikes.
Utah law says children under 14 can't use e-bikes without adult supervision, and those under 8 are not allowed to use e-bikes at all. Teenagers under age 16 are restricted from using Class 3 e-bikes, which have pedal assistance and can reach 28 miles per hour. Weishar says it's important for all riders, whether their bikes are electric or not, to follow the rules of the road. He says parents should reinforce bike safety with their children, especially the importance of wearing a helmet.
Bumps and bruises we could fix, but brain damage is really scary, and we don't want any of that to happen to anybody. A helmet is always a good idea. It's just like buckling up. This is the best you can do on a bicycle.
Wasatch County hasn't yet adopted formal speed limits or other rules for e-bike usage. In neighboring Summit County, riders must stay below the 15-mile-per-hour speed limit on all major bike paths. Midway is in the process of finalizing a contract with Heber City Police for daytime patrolling in the town. Traffic enforcement, including e-bikes, is one concern Midway Council members have said they want the new police presence to address. Mayor Celeste Johnson says she's optimistic officers can begin work sometime next week, but she says local leaders are still debating the best path forward to regulate e-bike use in Midway.
Our hesitation with declaring some kind of a speed limit for e-bikes is that it sends a message that it's okay to be on them on the trails, and we're not sure we even want them on our trails. We think e-bikes are probably more appropriate on the road, and if they're on the road, in my opinion, the kids should be 16 or older. They should have a driver's license.
That way, all e-bike users will be required to know the rules of the road. She says Midway is seeing problems with young e-bikers in particular. Johnson says Midway's Main Street is State Route 113, so its speed limit, crosswalks, and stoplights are dictated by the Utah Department of Transportation. The town could give feedback, but doesn't have final say. She says the City Council will discuss possible e-bike rules at its meeting Tuesday. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with me now, I've got Park City Economic Development Program Manager Jenny Dearson and Joe Cronley with the Park City Rotary Club. Good morning to both of you. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning, Parker.
Well, we want to get into Miners Day stuff. Before that, Jenny, I understand we've got some events this weekend to talk about. I guess we'll start with the big point-to-point race going on trails around town. What should people know?
Yeah, point-to-point is going to be on Saturday. The trail impacts, most important for folks to know, is really you should be riding the resorts or basin trails in the morning and ride Round Valley and Quinns in the evening to avoid those impacts. The event does kick off at Quinns Junction early in the morning on Saturday. So again, to avoid those impacts, hit the resorts and basin in the morning and then Quinns and Round Valley in the afternoon there.
Yeah, and then after taking the last 5 weeks off, Park City Sunday Market is also, I understand, returning this weekend?
Yeah, they are. They have, I think, about four Sundays left, so they'll run from this coming Sunday through September 22nd. And again, that's on Lower Main Street if you want to come and participate in those festivities and with the vendors and music and everything else going on down there. It'll be a fun way to kick off or be part of the holiday weekend.
Yeah, and then, of course, the big events on Monday. We've got Miners Day. I guess we'll start with the logistical stuff. What should people know? What's going to be closed?
Yeah, so on all of Main Street, Park Avenue from 9th to 15th Street is the parade route. So top of Main to very bottom of Main, and then 9th Street all the way down really to the 7-Eleven. Also South City Park, the Brew Pub, Bob Wells, Swede Surface Parking, and Flagpole Lot, that'll all close from 6 a.m. until 1 p.m. So again, just mind those road closures. It is a 6 a.m. Time for no parking in those areas. We expect a hard closure sometime between about 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. Just ahead of the parade. And then I wanted to mention just free parking and free transit. Our partners at both resorts, Park City and Deer Valley, are offering free parking with transit to Main Street. And then also Park City High School and Richardson Flat are other locations. Specifically, Richardson Flat will have increased transit, so above and beyond their normal transit routes during the parade. So from 9:05 until 1:15 p.m., there will be 10-minute frequency through Richardson Flat for anyone parking out there to get to the parade. And then I do want to mention, last year I loved it. There were so many people that brought bikes up to this event. But the city has over, I think, 100 kind of bike parking spaces around the downtown. So if you are riding your bike, please plan to kind of figure out where you're going to park your bikes. We love seeing those e-bikes, but also make sure you're following speed limits on our trails. It's a very busy time on the trails for that day, so we just want to make sure people get there safely. And then if you are driving your car, paid parking is $15. That's a flat rate from 8 o'clock until 1. And then just a reminder to everybody that is entry from MARSAC only, because Sweet Alley will be closed for the parade setup. And then after the parade at 1 o'clock, parking is free for the rest of the day. That's something new that we're doing specifically on holidays after major events. We want people to hang out downtown and go to all the wonderful festivities that the Rotary Club has helped put together. So just a reminder for what to expect there.
And does the city do the bus lane on Deer Valley Drive for Miner's Day?
We do, yeah. So the buses will be using that bus lane on Deer Valley Drive, and also our float participants will be able to get right in that bus lane to make sure they get on Sweet Alley.
All right, well, let's get into the fun stuff. Joe, let's walk through the day. I understand a lot of stuff starts with breakfast and the race in the park. What can you tell me about the lineup
Monday? That's the early part of the morning. 7:30, St. Mary's Church is providing breakfast there at City Park, like they have done for at least 15 years, maybe 20 years. So that's a great way to start the morning. They'll be serving from 7:30 to 9:30. And then right around the same area, Miners Hospital, we're going to have the 5K, and that's put on by the Twilight Rotary Club. That starts at 8 a.m., and just a cool, casual 5K. I think there's some people that take it seriously, but not too many.
You got it.
But, yeah, usually that's over by 8:45, 9 o'clock, and a lot of those participants just carry right over into the breakfast and grab some eggs and pancakes and sausage. So a great, great local event, and actually the whole day is kind of different than the 4th of July parade in that we don't have as many tourists, certainly from Salt Lake. Some people do come up, but the crowds are a little bit thinner, and it just seems has a little bit more of a local vibe.
Totally. And, you know, I think a lot of people around here understand the running of the balls event, but can you kind of give us a breakdown for people that maybe have never seen one before? You know, what are they going to see on Monday?
Sure. So after you get done with the 5K and get your belly filled with breakfast, work your way up to Main Street. Things will probably start happening between 9 and 9:30 for spectators, I would say. The Rotary Club and volunteers will be at it early, you know, as early as 8 a.m. But, yeah, you can get running of the balls tickets there on Main Street. There will be people selling tickets there. You can do that right now if you go to parkcityminer'sday.org. That's our website, and there will be directions there to get your balls there. Secondly, we have a special running of the balls this year. We did this last year, but this one's a little bit different. You can buy these special silver balls. There's 200 of them. They're $100 each, but there'll be one winner, but it's a $3,000 prize. It's $1,000 of airfare from Delta Airlines, $1,000 at Cole Sport, I believe, and then $1,000 lodging, something. Anyway, more on the website. I should know that, but I don't this morning. I'm sure it's in front of me, but that kind of got buried. Anyway, running of the balls will start at 10:30. So, yeah, it's always a cool thing to watch. And this year we have a new tower. It's called Tower 2.0. No longer made of wood, now made of metal, I think aluminum primarily. And it is OSHA approved. So we are, moving into the 21st century, making sure everybody's safe. So if you want to check out the tower, it'll be up around Cowes on Main Street. Just a cool place to be hanging out on Miner's Day before the parade, watch the running of the balls, grab some coffee at Cowes or one of the other coffee shops around, and talk to some of your friends and neighbors.
Yeah, and then parade begins at 11? Is it 11?
Yeah,
start?
The parade will begin at 11-ish, usually a little bit later than that. We got to clean up all the running of the balls. There will be 15,000 balls that come pouring down Main Street, and all the money we raise, this is our main fundraiser for Rotary, goes towards local nonprofits. We have a grant process that you can apply to, and so that money stays in the community, which we have plenty of good causes here. But yeah, the parade will start around 11. I'm not sure how many entrants we have. Typically, it's a little bit less than 4th of July, but I would say it's probably 30 to 40.
I think as of yesterday, I heard it was 45.
So a little bit more than normal. But yeah, so a lot of fun local things going on with as far as parade entrance.
Yeah,
and that'll go all the way down Main Street, all the way on Park Avenue. I mean, I kind of like watching it in front of the library myself, but.
Yeah, and can you tell us a bit about the events going down in City Park after the parade?
Yes, so after the parade, 12:30, that's when the mucking and drilling is back. We had an exhibition last year, or maybe the last couple of years. This year we're bringing back a competition, so we'll have four or five entrance in each of the mucking and drilling competitions. That starts at 12:30, probably will go till 1:30, maybe 2, depending how long things take there. Also, we've got a beer garden and food trucks at City Park. That's going to be going from 11:30 right after the parade all the way to like 4 p.m. Also have music that's programmed by Mountain Town Music there at the gazebo in City Park. So bands will be changing out throughout the afternoon, and then kids games at 12:30. Who's
always
doing
fun.
That? Yeah, Kevin Kennedy from the Rotary Club is heading up the kids games. Always a good thing if you got little tykes. Always super fun to enter them and watch that if your kids like mine are grown up but used to do that. Super fun. Yeah, I wanted to put a plug in for Canis Hart. He led the effort to replace our tower for the running of the balls. And Corey Forsling, I understand, is not going to be at Miners Day this year, but she's put in a lot of effort to put all the online entrance into buying tickets for running of the balls and the silver balls as well. So thanks to Corey as well.
Yeah, and Jenny, the city plans to unveil some new art along the rail trail on Monday as well.
Yeah, so that has been we've worked really closely with the Friends of Ski Mining Mountain History. And so we are excited. We have an artist who is installing a new piece of art. This is made of the remnants from the Daily West headframe, which we erected about, I think it was 2 years ago now. So super excited to see this newest piece of public art. It'll be kind of right on the corner of Bonanza, where the rail trail is, and we invite everyone to come out and celebrate, meet the artists, and talk to the Friends about the work that they're doing for mining preservation, and that'll be at 4 o'clock on Miners Day. So we ask everyone to come out, and we'll have some refreshments there for people as well. And then I also wanted to mention one really cool thing that also happens is the Friends also will be doing tours of the Miners Hospital, which doesn't happen that often. Mm-hmm. And so it's really cool to go in there and kind of get a history of the Miners Hospital while you're over at City Park or right after you watch Mucking and Drilling. It's a great opportunity to go over and check out Miners Hospital and learn about some of that history.
It is a full slate of events for Monday. It should be a fun day. Anything else? I'm about out of time. Anything else you want to mention?
The only other quick thing I wanted to mention is next week is Tour de Suds, which is a popular event. So if you're interested in registering for that, please go to mountaintrails.org.
Yep, and I failed to mention that thing at the Miners Hospital, but that's going from noon to 4. They'll have presentations about the history of Park City and Miners Hospital there.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you two coming in to give us the whole briefing on the weekend and Monday.
Thank you.
Yeah, come out and join us. Thanks, yeah. Parker.
We've been speaking with Park City Economic Development Program Manager Jenny Dearson and Joe Cronley with the Park City Rotary Club about Miners Day events on Monday. On the phone with me now, I've got Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis to discuss some of the top stories from the last month. How's it going, Lauren?
Not bad. How are you, Parker?
I'm pretty good. It's Friday. you know, I guess we'll start in Washington, D.C. There was some news the beginning of this week. Governor Cox attended a ceremony alongside former President Trump at Arlington National Cemetery. Some pictures went out for his campaign, and I understand that, I guess that was illegal?
Yeah, so a family from Utah had invited both Cox and Trump to Arlington National Cemetery. Their son was killed in a suicide bombing at Kabul Airport in Afghanistan about 3 years ago, and the family was marking, you know, the son's death and remembering him. And so both Trump and Cox attended and took photos, which is against federal law. You're not supposed to campaign or use images from Arlington National Cemetery and many cemeteries across the country, we learned over the course of this week, in campaign materials. And so There was an altercation between Trump's people and Arlington National Cemetery officials. A report was filed, and NPR had the story nationally. And, you know, we saw Cox in the pictures, and we thought, okay, well, Cox was with him. That's not good. And then the next day, we learned that Cox did the same thing that Trump did, which was he took photos from this event, and he sent out an email to supporters or prospective supporters saying, you know, let's remember this family and honor those who should serve. And if you'd like to donate, here's a link. If you'd like to put up a yard sign for me, here's a link. And fairly soon after that, folks started to respond, mostly on social, saying, you know, what is this? Can't believe it happened. And so Cox's campaign apologized. We tried to reach the campaign and ask them what the heck happened. They referred us back to Cox's office saying, well, you know, this was an official visit. This wasn't a campaign visit, and yet it was a campaign event. So a lot of back and forth, you know, there was an apology. Cox did say this shouldn't have happened. But at the end of the day, it did. And there were plenty of people who were pretty upset about the series of events.
Yeah, and this, you know, it kind of marks the shift that Cox has made from, you know, saying very sternly that he wasn't going to vote for President Trump to, after the assassination attempt, coming out pretty firmly for him.
I think there's a lot of people who are wondering what's happening, you know, here, and how Cox would make such a shift in such a short period of time. But yes, you're right, Parker. Cox came out and endorsed Trump last month after voicing opposition previously.
Yeah, well, turning to more kind of local affairs now, following the Utah Supreme Court's ruling over the legislature's efforts to buffer that redistricting ballot initiative, GOP lawmakers, came together last week and seemed to be moving pretty swiftly. How can you kind of break this down for us in terms of what the impact is?
Yeah, Parker, I think this one's pretty big. You know, most people are focused on the top of the ticket, thinking about who they're going to vote for president of the United States. Certainly understand that. That's a big deal, right? But what we're talking about here in Utah has potential to impact the lives of Utahns, in my opinion, more directly. And that is a redistricting lawsuit. So give me just a second. I'm going to go as fast as I can, but I want to go back to 2018. When Utah voters passed Proposition 4, which prohibited partisan gerrymandering. If you were here, remember, it was a big deal, right? Which means that lawmakers could not draw political boundaries to benefit any one party. A little over a year later, legislators passed a bill that removed the ban on gerrymandering, and then they started to draw their own maps. Ultimately, they drew a map for Congress, and Utah has four members of the House of Representatives and four districts. And that map split Salt Lake County into four pieces. A bunch of people were upset, filed a lawsuit. It wound its way through the courts, ultimately made it to the Supreme Court, where it sat for 2 years until this summer, when the Supreme Court ruled that all political power is inherent in the people, and they have the right to alter or reform their government as public welfare may require. So, no surprise, lawmakers didn't like that ruling. They've added a ballot question, a question on your ballot, a ballot initiative on this ballot. So when we vote on November 4th, it'll be there. And essentially they're asking the public whether the public wants the Supreme Court's ruling to stand, i.e. that the public should be able to add things to the ballot and that the legislature has to honor those things if they're passed, or if lawmakers should have, as they have in the recent past, an ability to amend an initiative if it is passed by the people. So that'll be on the ballot on November 4th. And I would say it's a big deal, right? Because it impacts not just those gerrymandered districts, but any other ballot initiative that people would like to bring forward. So recently, Utahns have brought forward medical marijuana. They brought forward Medicaid for All. And it is hard to do in Utah, and it's hard to get it to stick. If this law were passed, that would remain the same. If it were not, if voters voted no, there would be more flexibility with respect to the will of the people to inform the government.
Yeah, and, you know, have lawmakers kind of made clear the kind of argument they're set to make for this ballot initiative?
Yeah. Their principal argument, I would say, or one of their principal arguments, one of the things we hear first is that we don't want to become California. And in California, it's very easy to get an initiative on the ballot. It's not so easy to get an initiative on the ballot, but in Utah, that is. But if this law, if voters vote down what lawmakers have proposed, it would be hard for any ballot initiative to be changed by lawmakers if it were passed. And that is the same in California, right? And so they're saying, well, we're not sure the public knows best all the time. Look at what's happened in California with Prop 13, which is a housing bill with some home insurance things, with some homelessness things. We're just not sure that state is run all that well. So, you know, trust us. Let's make sure that we have one more layer of oversight and that we don't become California.
Yeah. Well, that will certainly be something to watch. You know, a few weeks ago, I feel like it made pretty big national coverage of the, I believe it was the 13 books that were banned in the state. You know, what can you tell us about what led to that?
Sure. So Utah became one of the first states, if not the first state, to take action on banning a whole bunch of books at the same time in school libraries all across the state. And the law essentially was passed in this past legislative session. It took effect July 1. And that's when people started to get to work on, okay, just what does the list look like and what books are going to go? So the Utah State School Board banned or ordered the removal of 13 books from every public school in the state earlier this month. Six of the 13 titles are written by a fantasy romance author named Sarah Moss. She's very popular. If you look at, you know, bestseller lists and so on and so forth, she's right up at the top. But there are some other recognizable names there, including Judy Blume for a book that is, to be clear, not necessarily targeted at kids. It's not a young adult book, some of Judy Blume's other books, right? But there's a process. There are multiple school districts that must say, we think these books should be banned. And then, you know, a review takes place and then those books are ordered to be removed. So lots of folks upset saying this was censorship. This is, you know, not how we should operate. People should be able to think independently and, you know, make up their own minds about what it is that they want to read. The Salt Lake City Public Library came out after and said, hey, we've still got these books on our shelves. We're still stocking them, which ironically is, you know, kind of funny in that I'm not sure the books are on the shelves. Every time we spot check, they are checked out. But you know, they're still providing the 13 banned books. They said they'll continue to provide books that may be banned in the future. This is intellectual freedom. A founding value of public libraries is trust and that individuals can choose for themselves what to read.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly, in the state, if three school districts ban a book, that automatically bans it statewide?
Three school districts or two school districts and five charters. So that's the process. The school board can reverse the process if it likes. So if it disagrees with a proposed book ban, the school board can say, well, actually, we don't think this book should be banned. So far, to my knowledge, they haven't done that. But, you know, we've got a few more, I'm sure, cycles of this before we're done with it.
Yeah, running out of time, but quickly here, maybe not the best story to end on, but in southern Utah, I understand at Zion National Park, they're grieving over the loss of their beloved California condor, 1K. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, 1K was the 1,000th California condor launched in this recovery program that was started way back in the 80s. Long story short, condors feast on carcasses of dead animals. There's oftentimes lead bullets in those dead animals, and these birds can get lead poisoning. So there is quite a bit of work being done to encourage hunters to use bullets that are not lead-based, and you know we're making progress there. But the hope is that we can continue to go down that road so we don't lose more condors like 1K, which if you've been to Zion, everybody loves seeing the condors. Everybody loves, you know, looking up in the sky and trying to spot them. And so a little bit of a bittersweet story, but there is a solution if we can get lead bullets out of the carcasses of these animals that are being hunted.
Yeah, quite a fascinating creature. I appreciate you calling in, Lauren, and keeping us updated on all the news going on around Utah.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
You too. Have a good weekend.